Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of July 9th, 2018. On this week's show, Grant Wall of Sports Illustrated and Fox Sports will join us from Moscow to talk about the week that was in the World Cup and the upcoming semifinals between Belgium and France and England and Croatia. We'll also be joined by The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham for a conversation about his piece headlined Stephen A. Smith Won't Stop Talking. And finally, Sports Illustrated's John Wertheim will be here to chat about the documentary Strokes of Genius on the epic 2008 Wimbledon final between Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Stefan Fatsis is in Iceland this week, where he is hopefully watching soccer games in gas stations. Filling in for him is the head of Hang Up and Listen's Oakland Bureau, Slate contributing writer Nick Green. How's it going, Nick?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you doing, Josh?
Good. Icelandic gas station is sort of the vibe that we're going for on this show, but like your house in Oakland will suffice for today.
Well, that's actually my interior design theme. It's my inspiration is an Icelandic gas station.
All right, perfect. I will be imagining that as we lead into our first segment here. The semifinal stage of the World Cup is upon us, and it is going to be a very good semifinal stage. On Tuesday, we're going to get Belgium and France, both of which have insanely talented rosters and have the feel of deserving tournament winners. And then on Wednesday, we've got England versus Croatia and all the drama of the English trying to overcome their Englishness, while the brilliant Luka Modric tries to lead his Croatian squad to the final in what will likely be his last World Cup. To discuss those upcoming games and the games of the recent past, let's bring in Grant Wall, who's joining us from Moscow. Grant writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, talks about it on Fox Sports TV, and in his Planet Football podcast. He's also the author of the book Masters of Modern Soccer, How the World's Best Play the 21st Century Game. Welcome, Grant.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. I want to start with Belgium because two of the main figures in your book were Vincent Kompany, the defender, and coach Roberto Martinez. This is an incredibly talented roster and one where the players seem to mesh together despite having different playing styles and different backgrounds. Can you give us a bit of a behind-the-scenes look at what makes this team work?
They have a tremendous amount of talent individually on this Belgium team. And the term you always hear in the soccer world is golden generation. But that is definitely true. But they had also underperformed as a national team in many ways over the years. And it was actually a disappointment for Belgium when it only got to the quarterfinals of the last World Cup and went out in the quarterfinals of Euro 2016 against Wales. And then Martinez came in with what he talked about as the goal to make this team better than the sum of its parts, because that hasn't been the case in recent years. And company talked a lot about how potential is one thing, but they had never actually won anything and really needed to find a chemistry as a team in this World Cup. And it really seems like they found it, you know, just in terms of the way they play together, and they have blended different styles of their star players, many of whom play in the English Premier League, but also have gotten results. And they're just tremendously entertaining to watch. The front three of De Bruyne, Lukaku, and Hazard, they've just been absolutely terrific. And Martinez, I thought, made a smart move in the game against Brazil in the quarterfinal by moving De Bruyne higher up the field from the midfield to a winger position. And he was fantastic in that game.
I wanted to ask you about that front three of Lukaku, De Bruyne, and Hazard. Of those three players, which who has impressed you the most? Who has like shown you kind of form that's gone above and beyond their Premier League performances?
You know, they've all three sort of done it in different ways in this tournament. You know, you look at Lukaku, and he's actually missed several scoring chances in the tournament, and yet he's been really, really good in other ways. On their late breakaway, you know, counter goal to beat Japan 3-2, maybe the most thrilling goal of the tournament in some ways, Lukaku didn't even touch the ball, and yet he did so many other things on that play to help create the goal, twice making runs to create space for other Belgian players, and then playing just an unbelievable dummy in the box that Nasser Chadli ran onto and scored. And that type of just great vision and understanding for the game is something that Lukaku has shown quite a bit in this tournament. He's not just about athleticism. And I've really enjoyed seeing that side of his game, even if I'm sure he wishes he had scored more goals in this tournament. De Bruyne just has a wonderful feel for the game. And then Hazard is really a guy I was really impressed the other night. We've seen him in the Premier League over the years with Chelsea. He controls things. He calms things down. You can give him the ball in a really tough spot, and he'll know what to do with it in a high-pressure situation. Sometimes that involves just sort of holding it. Sometimes he'll take more of a risk and advance the ball. I know the one of the goals against Japan in their comeback, he created space out of nothing and then sent a ball in that Fellaini headed home. And Hazard just seems to make the right decision just about every time he's on the ball.
I mean, that's the guy that I've noticed. I don't watch as much Premier League as either of you guys, but, you know, in the Belgium game against the U.S. in the knockout round in 2014, Lukaku and De Bruyne scored goals. So obviously, if you're a fan of the U.S. men's national team, you know those guys. But I remember Hazard being kind of disappointing in that game. And maybe, Grant, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like he's the guy who's really elevated his performance in this tournament up to what it's been at club level, and somebody who maybe hadn't done that in the big tournaments before.
Maybe not with Belgium as much. And you're right, in 2014, Hazard wasn't nearly as good as he's been in this tournament. You know, they underperformed at the Euro in 2016. Thibaut Courtois, the terrific goalkeeper for Belgium, who made such a big save late against Neymar in Brazil to preserve that victory, he was publicly critical of their coach, Mark Wilmots, when they went out in Euro 2016. And, you know, I think Courtois in particular has been very solid, very steady, has made some spectacular saves in this tournament. And you don't see him publicly criticizing the coach, Martinez, or anything else that's going on here. And, you know, we sort of wondered how good Belgium was in the group, because their group, aside from England, was pretty weak. With Panama and Tunisia. But we've seen in the knockout rounds against Japan and then against Brazil, they are so explosive from an attacking sense. And against Brazil, they were able to shore up some of the defensive problems that allowed them to concede two goals against Japan.
For their opponents, for France, what's your evaluation of how Coach Didier Deschamps has been doing so far? Because I know he's gotten some criticism, but the results have obviously been there this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes Deschamps is criticized for being too conservative and not fully utilizing the amazing talent that he has on that roster for France. But I thought he made a move that was a very good one, similar to the one that Martinez made early in the tournament. You know, Deschamps changed things up and put Olivier Giroud in as a center forward with Kylian Mbappe and Antoine Griezmann running off of him. And even though Giroud is a center forward, he's not really being asked to score goals in this tournament. He's really being asked to put the ball on, you know, help get the ball to Mbappe, to Griezmann, and put them in positions to score and really, you know, be a load to handle for the back line of whatever team they're playing. So I think Giroud is another guy who, in a similar way to Lukaku, doing things besides scoring goals that have been tremendously important. I think Giroud's been doing that as well. And maybe that's a little bit to do with sort of the tactical trends in the game that center forwards aren't always being asked to score goals.
For England, as Eric Betts pointed out in a piece for Slate, they've scored 8 of their 11 goals off of set pieces. You mentioned the, you know, weak group before, you know, England, that, you know, England and Belgium were in. They landed against, you know, a Colombian team that didn't have James Rodriguez, a Swedish team that is, you know, Sweden. They're not like one of the top nations, soccer-playing nations in the world. I'm wondering, Grant, if you think that this English team truly is different, or if this is a case of them getting a lucky draw and maybe not being as, like, supremely talented as the other teams that we've talked about so far.
Well, we'll find out in, you know, the next couple of games if England really can hang with the other three semifinalists. You know, I'm actually pretty, you know, feeling pretty positive about this England team. They're a younger team than previous England teams. They're very likable in a way that not all previous England teams have been. And they really play well together. And, you know, the set-piece goals I look at as a really impressive achievement of their coach, Gareth Southgate, and his staff, who have clearly spent so much time preparing set-piece routines, getting players to work together on sort of, you know, combinations, patterns that help, you know, lead to these types of goals. And, you know, when we started this tournament, I remember looking at the bracket and thinking, you know, England and Germany were on a collision course to meet in the quarterfinals, and Germany didn't do its part to get there, and the defending champions went out in the group stage. They were pretty poor, and England did its job. They got to that quarterfinal. It happened to be Sweden that they faced instead, but I don't think England owes anyone any apologies for Germany not making it there. So you play, you know, who you can, you know, who's in front of you. And we'll find out, I think, a little more about this England team in the semifinal against Croatia, because at times in this tournament, I thought in the group stage, Croatia was the best of the 32 teams, just based on on-field performance. And actually, Croatia hasn't been as good the last couple of knockout round games, but they've been good enough to advance against Denmark and then against Russia. But you know, right now, I think it's a pretty even matchup heading into this semifinal, and we could actually see England get to a World Cup final.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say that, like, preparation is for nerds or anything like that. It's just that England just hasn't been as impressive or creative during open play as the other teams in this tournament, I think it's fair to say. And that piece I mentioned, Eric Betts wrote that their offense is more like the illusion of offense than the actual thing, like a man sticking his finger in his coat pocket and pretending it's a gun. I thought that was a clever line. But I think there might actually be some self-loathing here from me, because when I watch England play, what I think is, if the U.S. men's national team is ever really good, like, this is how they're going to be good. Like, there's nobody on the field for England who you're, like, totally blown away by from a skill standpoint, but they are, like, really solid. They play well together. They're extremely well prepared, and they do have some skill, but it just looks to me like this is the best possible version of the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You know, if you look back at, like, the 2002 men's World Cup, when the U.S. men got to the quarterfinals, that's sort of how they played, you know, and there's nothing wrong with being a team that is really hard to play against, that does well on set pieces, you know, and occasionally scores goals out of the run of play. The goals all count the same. And I do think sometimes in the soccer world, people look down at set piece goals. But I have a whole story on set piece goals in this tournament in Sports Illustrated magazine this week. And, you know, it's something that more and more people in the sport, not just national teams, but also at club level, are hiring set piece specialists to try and maximize the possibility of scoring as many goals as possible over the course of a season or a tournament with set pieces. Because, you know, about 20 to 30% of all goals typically come off set pieces. And it's an area of the game that hasn't been, there's been a lot of inefficiencies over the years and it hasn't been maximized. And now teams that are really working at doing that are benefiting.
Set piece specialist is a good job for you, Nick, if the writing thing doesn't work out.
I'm already working on it. So for Croatia, they've won two penalty shootouts in a row. So my data says that if their match against England goes to penalties, they're due to lose one. However, my data also says that England is England. So do you think that Croatia has any unique skill that if this does go to penalties that England should be worried? Or do you think that this is going to be figured out in regulation?
You know, I mean, the chances are that you won't be seeing Croatia go to a third straight penalty shootout. It's certainly possible. We've seen quite a few of them in the knockout rounds. And Subasic, the Croatian goalkeeper, is absolutely terrific at stopping penalties.
Is he okay? Is his hamstring okay? Do you know?
Yeah, there's some questions. You know, I don't know the answer to that yet. I think it's going to be a pretty big talking point heading into the semifinal against England. But it was pretty amazing. You know, it looked like he had pulled his hamstring late in the game against Russia. Maybe it was just a cramp. But whatever it was, he went from looking like he wasn't going to be able to continue to not only continuing, but doing very well in the shootout. And, you know, he was terrific in the shootout against Denmark in the round of 16. So, you know, I think that's it's nice to have a hot goalkeeper in a situation like that. Jordan Pickford, the England goalkeeper, did really well in the shootout against Colombia. That was the first time England had ever won a penalty shootout at a World Cup. And, you know, just to see typical England fans who are, you know, usually pretty pessimistic, especially about penalties and their
pretty
response,
pessimistic.
in their response, about life too. I'm working with, you know, several folks from England here at Fox, you know, with Fox Sports at the World Cup, and they're sort of, they found this new optimism, which is jarring.
So
they're getting set up. This is going to be bad.
It is going to be bad. I also like to see Luka Modric happy. He's got like a really good post-game smiley face, and so I wouldn't mind seeing that again. Plus, he's just a great player, and I like to see the great players who haven't won before get the chance to hoist the cup.
The best midfielder in the world, I would say at this point, and that's actually been that way for a while, and yet maybe it's because at Real Madrid, Cristiano Ronaldo has sucked so much of the oxygen out of the place that Modric almost feels underrated, even though he plays for Real Madrid and is in a World Cup semifinal. And I kind of feel that way about Ivan Rakitic, his teammate, even though he plays for Barcelona. So, you know, I think we're seeing these guys who, you know, are just such a talented generation that Croatia has had, you know, fully realizing what we thought they might be able to do.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated. He is also a correspondent for Fox Sports. He has a podcast, Planet Football, and he's the author of the book, Masters of Modern Soccer, How the World's Best Play the 21st Century Game. Grant Wall, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Good talking to you.
Before we get to Stephen A. Smith, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Christina Cotarucci will join us for a lesson on how to say goal for a very long time. Nick, I'm not going to say goal for very long now because I want to save my breath for the bonus segment. I would suggest that you do the same.
Yeah, God, I'm not even going to say anything to save my voice. It's the last thing I'm saying.
Christina can say goal for 40 seconds. I just want to warn people, just be prepared to put on your listening ears. If you want to hear that
conversation.
I thought you weren't going to say anything, Nick.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, right. That's it. Pearl Diver, last one.
If you want to hear that conversation, you should join Slate Plus for just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangup+.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, it's Josh, your friend from the podcast. Just a note that due to a technical issue, Nick is going to sound slightly different for the rest of the podcast from how he did in the first segment. So don't be alarmed, or be alarmed. It's up to you. But just noting that difference.
What? Oh my, you should be banned from talking like, basketball. That is blasphemous. I'm calling you out. I'm so sick of these people. You know,
That man you just heard, and boy, did you just hear him, was Stephen A. Smith. Stephen A., who started out as a print journalist, has been a TV pundit since the late 90s, most famously and enduringly as a panelist on various ESPN debate shows. His main gig currently is First Take, on which he debates the news and non-news of the day with Skip Bayless's replacement, Max Kellerman, for 2 hours every weekday morning. In Vincent Cunningham's recent profile of Smith for The New Yorker, headlined, "Stephen A. Smith Won't Stop Talking," the subject said that his job is to be enough of a personality that they, meaning the audience, want to know what you think. Joining us now to talk about the man, the personality, and his job is Vincent Cunningham, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Vincent, it is a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I think partly because of the existence of your profile, it feels to me like we're in the strange new respect phase of Stephen A. Smith's career. There are certainly a lot of people who think he represents the ruination of sports television and the vacuousness of the embrace debate era. But I also think it's possible to put that aside and just appreciate what an amazing performer he is, because at least for me, as somebody who talks once a week and doesn't have the same kind of verbal felicity and command of my voice that he has, I just marvel at what it is that he's able to do every day.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that we have sort of passed into a new dispensation of sort of Smith appreciation, but I think it's not just that he's so amazing. I think he's also angled himself, interestingly, especially since Skip Bayless left the show for the pastures at Fox Sports 1, right? Like, I think he's embraced more, obviously, the sort of camp aspects of his job, which I think those of us who I actually watch this show, like people ask me if it's ironic, and it's no, because I think that Stephen A. Smith is like an opera performer. He's amazing, and he makes me laugh a lot. And so I think he's downplayed the parts of him that were more toxic and allowed us, I think, to appreciate, as you say, the, just his skills as a performer, which are, as you say, amazing. The guy talks for like 4 hours a day, every single day.
I'm curious just how you pitch this profile to your editors. How much explaining of Stephen A. had to go into it, or were they already familiar with his body of work?
Luckily, my editor is as big a sports fan and as big a sports media fan as I am. He knows who Stephen A. is, and I've talked about it just in passing. Every time I travel, especially, I always tell him, like, yeah, just watch him First Take on the hotel TV. And he's like, always asking me, are you joking? Is it ironic? He's like, no, it's one of the most comforting things in the world. Like, for whatever reason, Stephen A. Smith's voice is like a balm to me. So it was just kind of something that we had in our back pocket. He's like, you should write about that at some point.
There was like a first kind of round of Stephen A. profiles, as you mentioned in your piece, like in August 2005, yeah. There was a moment where he was in Sports Illustrated. Carl Taro Greenfield did a piece on him, and I went back and read it after reading your story. And it's really interesting to go back and look at it. And the thing that stuck out to me is that Mark Shapiro, who is an executive at ESPN from an earlier era, talks about how when he brought up the idea of hiring Stephen A. at ESPN, everybody at the network said they hated him. There were 28 people in the room and they were all vehement. No way, never, never.
Right.
And Shapiro goes, oh, well, obviously I had to hire him, which, you know, he's kind of positioned in the story as just like this morally bankrupt network executive who'll do anything for ratings. But it just reminded me of, again, like if we're in this like strange new respect era, just how hated he was and how polarizing he was back then.
Yeah. I mean, and it was, as that, you know, as that story kind of illustrates, it was in some ways more polarizing within ESPN than it even was outside of ESPN, because ESPN's, especially sort of the sports center descended, I guess you could call it the establishment within ESPN. My sense in reporting this piece was that those people have had more trouble accepting Stephen A's prominence than, you know, than audiences. There are people who certainly tune into First Take because they hate Stephen A and they like want grist for that, for that mill, and which makes all the sense in the world. But there are people who kind of revere the idea of ESPN that has the guy behind the desk, sort of genteelly going through, maybe with a little bit of irony, but certainly with a sort of some kind of reserve, going through sports highlights and things like this, where several people described First Take to me as a sort of comparably a wild, wild west, that it's just this place where people are like shooting off ridiculous things. And Stephen A, like even before First Take, kind of epitomized that approach, which I think the people at ESPN were always kind of like, that's not what we do.
I think it was interesting in your piece how you mentioned he has these kind of ambitions above and beyond First Take and his radio 2 hours of radio show, et cetera. And he was saying that you know, even hosting Sports Center is up there, and he got to host some special edition Sports Centers before the NBA Finals. And that just seems funny to me, because doesn't First Take kill Sports Center in the ratings?
Yeah, First Take kills everything in the ratings. But I don't think, but Stephen A, to my mind, is he's a very competitive guy. And to him, the success of First Take is kind of, you know, when an athlete wears weights while they work out and they say, well, imagine what I could do without, you know, it's kind of, that's what he sees, I think, his success like right now. First Take's on at noon, dude, and it's killing everything else. Imagine if I was on at prime time. Like, my radio show isn't even on at during drive time. Imagine if it was on in mornings or if it was on at 4 p.m. So to him, there is a subtle competition that he feels, even with his fellow talent there. I really believe that this is the kind of way that, you know, if you mention another show, he kind of like, he's a very competitive guy. I think that's part of his ambition.
It seems like the answer would be just to have him on 24 hours a day, because I think he'd gladly do that.
I mean, I think you could literally have a Stephen A cam, and it would be like, I mean, it would just be ESPN SAS, and it would be like, it'd be the highest rated thing you've ever seen.
Well, after the LeBron to the Lakers announcement, there's a video that I just watched yesterday that's him on Periscope, where it's just him like in like kind of a t-shirt just cackling. He just like, like he just turned on the camera, and it was like, this response to LeBron is already in progress. And it's just like, I imagine that he is just literally talking 24 hours a day. And you'd like capture it really well in the lead to your piece about how he's like talking about how almond milk gives you man boobs, and so he stopped drinking it. And there's like the famous David Roth tweet. I don't know, Vincent, if you're a fan of the tweet. It's an amazing tweet where, as Roth wrote, it's a dialogue between a P.F. Chang's waiter who is reciting specials, and then Stephen A. says, to me, that's preposterous. Crab Rangoon, things of that nature.
Right.
Can you just give us a little bit of a sense of what it's like to be in Stephen A. Smith's presence as he's talking about almond milk with the same kind of ferocity that he you know, talks about anything else?
It's truly amazing. I mean, what he's always asked, and it's always asked of the people who write about him, I learned this while writing about him, the first thing anybody asks you is he really like that in real life? Does he walk around like that? And the answer is like, sort of. He's not as loud, and he doesn't get as worked up as he has sort of perfected doing on First Take. But he certainly, he has the same facility with just like generating opinions as like he just is an opinion machine. You throw something his way and it, you know, it, he breaks down both sides of it and he takes a side. It's a skill that I think comes through so much of doing that. So he does that all day. And if it's something that has to do with him, right? Like I later on in the piece, I talk about how he just gets really worked up talking about how people call him a hack or sort of that's the best way to get him to talk about himself. Sometimes he can work himself up to like truly First Take levels, but that's when it's like sort of more personal. But it's sort of amazing. You're just there. The trouble with writing about him is that you could easily just as easily write a version of this piece that's just you being a stenographer all day, right? Like just quote after quote.
I can only imagine transcribing it. I have I have one gripe with your profile, and that is I had no idea that he had a recurring role on General Hospital as Brick, the security consultant. And I learned that through your profile. So if I hadn't read it, there's a legitimate chance I would have been just having General Hospital on in the background one day, or you know, at the gym it would be on one of the treadmills, and I would have seen Stephen A. Smith walk on and be totally stunned and surprised by that. And sadly, that moment is now taken away from me. But do you have any background on how that came to be? I mean, that's just insane to me. It's so funny.
They reached out to him. The producers reached out to him. And first he did a bit part that wasn't the one, this recurring role where he's like, he's a surveillance expert in the employ of Sonny Corinthos, who is the lead character on General Hospital. I think this is my understanding. But it sort of happened in a way of he just puts things out into the world and people are like, oh, Stephen A. Smith, you know, likes our show. We should get him on the show. Because, again, like they understand, and I think this is something that he's learned partially because of the show, is that he's learned, just as the producers of General Hospital have, like the aspects of camp that people like in their performance, you know? He's the kind of guy who I think just, like, calls things into being, you know? It's hilarious.
You mention in the piece one of the moments where Smith has come in for the most criticism, which was in 2014 when, you know, the Ray Rice situation happened. He said on First Take, let's make sure we don't do anything to provoke wrong actions, kind of implying that Rice's then fiance had provoked him into assaulting her, which was just like a horrifying and disgusting thing to say. He was suspended for a week. And he says in the piece that, you know, he was raised by five women. I would never hit a woman. I would never condone domestic violence, period. But, you know, something that you didn't mention is his continual defenses of Floyd Mayweather, which is a phenomenon that's been going on for years and years and years, where he's minimized Floyd's well-documented history of domestic abuse. I'm wondering if that's something that you discussed with him or thought about.
You know, I brought up the Ray Rice thing, hoping that it would lead into some of this other territory. I mean, I think it's underlying this kind of whole conversation is the extent to which sports TV is like this weird male and sometimes I don't know if toxic is the word, but there's certainly this zone where the kind of morality that pertains elsewhere doesn't always pertain in really kind of strange ways. We didn't actually talk as much about Floyd, but I think it's totally right about him, and I think it's just one of his biggest blind spots. Like, even, for example, like what you just mentioned, he like never has just been like, sorry, that was wrong. I realize like there's no way in which a woman can provoke a man. I can't even imagine what I was thinking, right? Like, he always says I was misunderstood. And so I think that the lesson for him there was like, don't say that, but I'm not sure that he totally gets it.
Yeah, it kind of seems born out of another kind of criticism that dovetails of Stephen A. with this is that he's too chummy with athletes and he can't give, you know, objective criticisms of people like Mayweather because he wants to be their friends or he likes being in their orbit. Yet he also has these kinds of bizarre personal feuds with specific athletes like Kevin Durant when he had that famous, you know, rant against him.
Yeah.
How does he pick and choose who he wants to be friends with and who he kind of uses as these foils for First Take and for his monologues?
Yeah. It's funny. I think that this has everything to do with his personal style, right? Like, even before he was on television, he was kind of, or before he was as much on television as he is now, I should say, he was kind of known as a friend of Allen Iverson's. But what that did when the Sixers made that 0-1 run to the finals was that he was one of the better sourced journalists anywhere in the NBA. And like, that's why he started getting on TV, because he knew everything about the Sixers locker room. And it was very explicitly because he was, like Stephen A. calls him, I mean, Iverson to this day calls Stephen A. Smith his big brother. And so that's what you have to give Stephen A. as a journalist. You can't deny the fact that he has been even up until 2010 when LeBron announced the decision, Stephen A. was the first person that came out and was like, he's definitely going to Miami. Like, he does have sources, and it is premised more on, I guess, what we would call friendship than it is on some enterprising gadfly model, right?
So, Vincent, that Durant Stephen A. Smith feud started in 2015 when Stephen A. said that he thought that he was hearing that if Kevin Durant doesn't stay in Oklahoma City, that he was going to go to L.A. And Durant responded by saying, "I don't talk to Stephen A. Smith at all. Nobody in my family, my friends, they don't talk to Stephen A. Smith. So he's lying." And so that's where it started. And I think that you can see kind of like the weaker sore spots with both guys. Like, Durant is a very sensitive guy, as we know. And Stephen A. definitely does not like people to impugn his journalistic chops and wants to remind people that he was a beat writer.
Right. And lying, I think, is the thing that...
Yeah, journalists don't like it when you say they're lying.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, Stephen A. did, like, you know, maintain, as he often does, maintain sort of a kind of, some kind of qualified zone around himself. Like, I'm hearing could be anybody, right? He's not necessarily saying that Kevin Durant's best friend called him and told him that, or that Kevin Durant himself told him that, or his mom told him that. But, you know, hearing is a pretty broad, you know, utterance, I guess, you know, so it's just one of those things where I just think he got, the lying thing got to, like you say, like his sorest spot in terms of his criticism. He doesn't care if people dislike him. He doesn't care if people think he's a buffoon. Like, he's heard all that stuff, and when you bring that stuff up to him, it bounces right off of him. He can point to the scoreboard, which is the ratings, and he does not care about that.
It's kind of interesting that, you know, this feud is essentially about Stephen A. getting something wrong, but I didn't remember the specifics. All I remembered was, oh, he had an argument with Kevin Durant. So therefore, right, they're kind of almost equals in this equation, even though one is a, you know, superstar athlete, the other one's someone who's reporting on him and reporting something that was proven to be wrong or turned out to be wrong.
And there's also that thing of like predicting what athletes are going to do in the future. It's always safe because, like, you know, you could have still heard that. He could have been thinking that and then changed his mind. It's like, at the end of the day, it's just a thing to say on TV. And I think Stephen A. wants to remind athletes that that's part of his job. You know, there's a moment in my piece where he talks about using, again, General Hospital as his model. Shaq is mad at him about something that he has said about him, you know, some criticism. And he reminds Shaq, like, hey, do you know that even if something bad happens in a soap opera, we all know that the hero's going to live at the end? It's like, my job is to make this interesting, even though maybe you're going to win. It's not, you know, he's trying to make athletes understand his part in this. And so when they are that negative toward him, I think it does kind of hurt his feelings, because I think he sees himself as part of the ecosystem that makes the game fun.
Yeah, I mean, and to wrap this up and to bring it back to what I was saying in the beginning, as far as how he makes it interesting, there's a great contrast, I think, to be made with Skip Bayless, who, you know, he definitely makes it interesting. I mean, I think he... comes off as an asshole, and the stuff that he's saying just feels like kind of mean, or and just the way that he approaches it. And I think it's partly due to, like, you know, reading about Skip and how he, like, eats chicken and broccoli every night. There's just, like, a fundamental, like, sadness to him and to what he does on television to me. And with Stephen A., you know, for all the faults that we've talked about, there's, like, a joy in the performance. And there's a joy, I think, in him doing what he does that really comes through in your piece.
Yeah, undeniable. He loves doing his job, and he seems to only want to do more of it.
Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His profile of Stephen A. Smith is headlined, "Stephen A. Smith Won't Stop Talking." Vincent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So Stefan and I talked to John Wertheim last week before Stefan went away to Iceland, and we talked about, as you'll hear in my intro in a second, this documentary about Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. We had a huge amount of hubris and thinking, oh, there's nothing nothing could possibly happen. Federer, Nadal, by the time we air this on Monday, July the 9th, they'll both still be in the tournament. And you know what, Nick? Hubris rewarded. Always be overconfident. That's what I have to tell you. So Nadal, Federer, both made it to the Wimbledon quarterfinals on Monday. They could meet in the final on Sunday. And here we go. Here's our conversation, me and Stefan and John Wertheim, that was recorded last week. As of July 6th, 2008, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal had won 14 of the previous 16 major championships. The two men had met in the previous four French Open finals, with Nadal winning all four, and in the previous two Wimbledon finals, with Federer winning both of those. The match they'd play at Wimbledon that July, which Nadal won in five sets, would change the course of their rivalry and would instantly be celebrated as the greatest tennis match ever played. That match is the subject of a new documentary, Strokes of Genius, which debuted last week on the Tennis Channel and which features interviews with Nadal and Federer, plus their coaches and trainers and relatives and legends, including John McEnroe, Bjorn Borg, Martina Navratilova, and Chris Evert. Joining us now to discuss the documentary and the Federer-Nadal rivalry, which is now in its 15th year, is John Wertheim. John is an executive editor and senior writer at Sports Illustrated, the author of the book Strokes of Genius, and the executive producer of the documentary based on that book.
Hey, guys.
Great to have you back, my friend. And it was a real pleasure to watch this documentary and to see athletes who are still, you know, at the top of their sport after all of these years be so reflective during their careers.
I think it's a total credit to those guys. And I think you're absolutely right. We all love 30 for 30s, but there is a big difference between athletes sort of playing retrospective and rehashing these career moments versus athletes who are absolutely in the throes, in this case, of this rivalry. I mean, they come to Wimbledon 1-2 in the world, and they've won alternately. They've won the last six majors, and they still agreed to sit down. And I thought both of them, in very different ways, went pretty deep on both this match, but I think more importantly on their relationship and the dynamics of rivalry. And I think it says a great deal about them that even at this stage in their careers, they'd be willing to do this.
It is really striking, and that was the first thing I was going to bring up to Josh, just how introspective and analytical both of them are about their place in the game and their relationship to each other. And I think my favorite recognition, John, was Federer's, that after losing to Nadal in this match 10 years ago at Wimbledon, the realization that that Nadal was necessary to him as an athlete, that he had been unbeatable, that Nadal came along with a game that challenged Federer to adjust, which he had never had to do before. And Federer, like in real time, understanding that and modifying his game so that we could have this 15-year rivalry.
Yeah, exactly. There's a great line in the movie where someone said it was as if Nadal were created for the express purpose of taking down Federer. I mean, you couldn't fashion a game that was more unfavorable to Federer, who had been ruling the roost and had been this sort of benevolent despot, and everybody loves Roger, and the runner-up would always say, you know, too good, I'm playing for second place, and here comes the Spaniard, and he doesn't necessarily, hew to the niceties of tennis, and he's a left-hander. Tactically, it's different. Sort of philosophically, it's different. And you're right. I think Federer, and he admits this in the film, it took him a while to warm up to this relationship. This is not somebody who necessarily relished the whole idea of challenge and rivalry. And after that, he would win Wimbledon, and Nadal would win the clay events and the French Open, and there seemed to be this almost a sort of sort of like a custody dispute. There's sort of this unspoken agreement, and when Nadal violated that and won Wimbledon and beat the great Roger Federer at the All England Club, where he'd won five straight years, I think Federer had. You're absolutely right. I think Federer had the sort of fight or flight moment and said, you know what, I really need to reassess how I feel about this rivalry because this guy is coming and taking what's mine.
I don't know what you guys thought, but I was looking at this as just another piece of the Federer-Nadal rivalry, and I thought Nadal won the documentary. Nadal, I guess we're not as used to hearing Nadal kind of go as deep. Like, Federer is famously open in press conferences and on-court interviews, and like, we're grateful for it as fans of his and as journalists that we get to hear so much of his thought process. But Nadal, in this documentary, speaking in his native Spanish, I thought went to places I never heard him go before. And I pulled a clip. This was my favorite Nadal moment from Strokes of Genius, if we can play that now.
No puedo saber lo que Tony pensaba decirme en aquel momento o no, pero yo estaba preparado para asumir el reto y para asumir la adversidad en todo momento. Y esto fue lo que le dije a Tony, ¿no? Yo no voy a fallar. Federer podía ganarme la final, pero yo no iba a perder la final. Si el otro me gana, me gana. Pero yo no voy a perder.
All right, before I explain what Rafa was saying in the clip, let me just give a little bit of backstory on the match. Nadal had won the first two sets, 6-4, 6-4. Federer had come back after Nadal had match points to win the third and the fourth sets, both in tiebreakers. And then there was a rain delay, as there were multiple rain delays in this match. So in the fifth set, they're going back to the locker room. Nadal's coach, his uncle Tony, is like, all right, I got to pump this guy up. He's blown a two-set lead. You know, what do I got to say to this guy? And this is, what Nadal says in that clip is, I don't know what my uncle Tony was going to say to me, but I was determined in that moment that I was not going to lose that match, that maybe Federer was going to win it, but I was not going to lose. And the way that he said it, I thought gave like incredible insight, and also just being kind of taken into that moment in the locker room, I thought was one of the highlights of the movie for me.
I think that was a great encapsulation of Nadal, and you sort of intuitively, you watch him play and you sense that's his mentality, but to hear him articulate it, which I don't think he had ever done before. And I do think it helped to interview him in Spanish when it's, the press conference in Cincinnati, or when you grab him for 5 minutes in a locker room, you don't necessarily have an interpreter, you can't use subtitles. This was different. And getting Nadal in the comfort of Spanish, I think we got a level of depth and introspection that we don't necessarily get in English. It's funny, I mean, Federer at some level is a victim of his own success, not just in tennis, but in press conferences and self-expression. And I think he wears that cloak very comfortably of being a spokesman. Nadal, less so, but I agree. I mean, I think Nadal was really went to a place that I didn't necessarily expect him to go. And I do think the luxury of interviewing him in Spanish. And also, we went to Mallorca, so there was a sort of a comfort with setting.
Also, but the luxury of interviewing him about a match that he won.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. I mean, Federer, keep in mind, lost this match. I mean, one of the more stinging moments of his career. This really, when they do the Federer career retrospective, this will not be one of the happier moments. And I think both of them, I think Federer is at a place where he understands in sort of the broader mosaic of tennis the importance of this match. But I also think that both of them don't just appreciate rivalry as a concept, but I think they both have a real appreciation for the dynamic of theirs. And I think they both take pleasure in the fact that they have this opponent and they have this nemesis, this other player to whom they're yoked, and yet it's civil. And they motivate each other, and sometimes Nadal goes on a run, and Federer's beaten Nadal the last five times they've played. But I think they both realize that ultimately they're much better for the existence of the other one.
That was one of my favorite parts of the movie as well, John. And not just as it refers to Nadal and Federer, but there's a sequence on the compassion and bonding among rivals in tennis. Chris and Martina on the women's side and Borg and McEnroe on the men's side were the ones that you focused on. And when McEnroe starts talking about Bjorn Borg retiring early at age 27, he's on the verge of tears. And McEnroe, right, who's in our image is this fiery bastard screaming on the court, is wistfully sentimental about the fact that he lost his challenger. He lost his rival and what that meant to him.
Says he would have been happy
as a competitor.
Says he would have been happy to be number two in the world if Borg was still playing.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think those windows of introspection into athletes, into great athletes, are rare. And so it wasn't just Nadal and Federer who were offering up some examples of that in this movie, John. It was these other athletes, too. And you also, and I think that this ties in with it, is just how lonely tennis can be at the top. That it's a one-on-one sport. You're out there with your rival. You go back to the locker room. And as I think Chris Evert said in the documentary, you're sitting in the same locker room as your bitter rival. And at that point, the match doesn't matter. It becomes about compassion. And I don't know whether that was true for Nadal and Federer sitting in the locker room after, say, Nadal beats Federer at Wimbledon for the first time. But for some athletes, it is.
Yeah, I think some of this, I think you're absolutely right. I think some of this is unique to tennis, which is a strange sport in that regard. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, here these guys are playing this global sporting event, and never mind before and after the match, even during these rain delays, they're both retreating to the same, this is not a big room. You know, this is not the Staples Center locker room. I mean, this is a little cubbyhole, and here they are in the middle of this final, this tense match, and they're sitting across from each other. But no, I mean, I think motivation is part of it. You know, McEnroe and Borg, great rival. They're still making movies about it 35 years later. They only play each other 14 times. So I think there's also a longevity here. And I think that no one thought Roger Federer, no one thought a tennis player would be number one in the world, almost 37 years old. Nobody thought Nadal with that physical, punishing, violent style would still be going strong at 32. And I think the fact that, as you say, this has been it's a 15-year rivalry, which is remarkable in tennis in particular in an individual sport, I think that plays into it as well.
So the thing that's always bugged me about how this match has been acclaimed by the John Wertheim types is that as the greatest ever was that the experience watching this match was pretty miserable. So this was before DVR at least was a presence in the Levine household. And these rain delays were brutal. Like, this was an all-day-long thing. It ruined lunch plans. It ruined dinner plans. But I'm, like, being a little bit facetious, but I wonder, John, if that at all, like, factors in for you when thinking back on this match. Because when it's portrayed in this, like, 90-minute package, there's only so much that you can do to, like, represent what it was like to actually experience. That was, like, a really long day. And for me, that actually meant the match wasn't as good as, like, you know, the Australian Open final in 2017, where they just, like, played the whole thing through and the drama just, like, never stopped.
Well, that's it. I mean, on 4th of July weekend, no less. That's interesting. I mean, here it was almost as though this was sort of the symphony, and the rain delays were these added rests.
You got to think about the viewers at home, John.
You got John McEnroe and Ted Robinson ad-libbing dried the courts. These are like the this was the tarp at Citi Field. But the one of the ironies is that this was the last match on center court before there was a roof. So had this happened a year later, A, you wouldn't have had rain delays, and B, you wouldn't have to worry about darkness. But
you would have had Federer playing indoors. He probably would have won.
indoor match. Federer's favorite and Nadal's least favorite. But, you know, the greatest match of all time. It's just like the writer doesn't write the headline. That's a I'm not sure that was my designation, but I stand by that. I just think it all added to the rhythms of this match. The uncertainty, again, the fact that these guys had to go back to the same dressing room, I think is just remarkable. You know, a middle school basketball team wouldn't think of getting dressed in the same room as the opposition. And here are these two guys sitting on two benches across from each other. And I just think that the sets were 6-4, 6-4, 7-6, 7-6, and then 9-7. To me, that's I stand by the greatest of all time. My apologies for rain delays that would have condensed it and freed up time. You were 5 hours, hours ahead.
It did not ruin your dinner. I'm sorry. Exactly. It did not ruin your dinner.
Well, you know, exactly. Other things got pushed back. You know how it can go on a Sunday, Stefan. We're busy people. The other thing that I wanted to mention that just really struck me was Nadal saying that Federer's famous backhand pass down 8-7 in the fourth set tiebreak was the worst moment of his life.
Of his life.
I know. That seemed like a little bit of an exaggeration. Life. But that, in a match that Federer lost, I think just because of the way that Federer is, you know, seen by the world, that backhand pass to save match point, I think for me, it was like the standout moment in the match. What was it for you, John?
I think that's the one. And part of this, honestly, is you learn a lot about making TV and making documentaries. And if this were print, you would simply use the quote. As it turned out, it came out a little bit muddled. But what Nadal's point was, he had a forehand that he had lined up, and he's thinking to himself, if I convert this forehand that I've hit innumerable times, if I convert this, I'm the Wimbledon champion.
Yep.
And he lines it up and takes a whack, and wouldn't you know it, the ball comes whistling by him. Federer hits this unbelievable backhand that I think sort of was filled with symbolism as well as with just this gorgeous piece of shot making. And at that moment, part of you said, oh my gosh, this Federer, we always knew he was a great player, but maybe we didn't give him enough credit as a fighter. Maybe this guy sort of has, you know, it was Matsvilander who a few weeks before had said he doubted whether Federer, you know, Nadal has much bigger balls. And this was Federer showing, you know, testicular fortitude. But you also at that moment said, oh my gosh, if Federer wins this match and Rafael Nadal has a forehand to win Wimbledon and doesn't convert it and loses in the final to Federer three straight times, but this one holding match point, will he ever be the same player? And I think, you know, we talk about rivalries in other sports, and even with Borg and McEnroe, there's sort of this element often of destruction. And after the final match, after the rubber match, Mickey Ward and Arturo Gatti, I mean, pick your rivalry. Often in an individual sport, the loser is never the same again. And I think part of what makes this so heartening, Federer won the very next major. I mean, here everybody left Wimbledon 2008, wondered if the king had been deposed, and there was all sorts of tortured analogies to overthrowing and coups and putsches, and there's a new king. But Roger Federer won the U.S. Open a few weeks later. He won Wimbledon in 2009. He won the French Open in 2009. Nadal won the Australian Open. So in many ways, the fact that this, you had the seminal match, but it did not sort of neuter the loser. It, in a way, sort of emboldened both of them, I think was, I think it's another special part of this rivalry.
The documentary is called Strokes of Genius. It's in heavy rotation on Tennis Channel. It's based on John Wertheim's book, Strokes of Genius. John, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And over the weekend, Nick, you wrote about the English football. Do we have to say football anthem?
It's been recording. This podcast been recording in America, so we can say soccer.
All right, the soccer anthem. Football is coming home.
Do football.
And how it's kind of become like a meme and a joke, and how the English players are, you know, in interviews they're answering questions about whether football is coming home. Let's begin by just listening to a little excerpt from the tune.
Football's coming.
So, Nick, tell us a little bit about the background of this song.
The English FA, the governing body that kind of runs English soccer, before the 1996 European Championships, which were being held in England, commissioned a song, an anthem for that tournament and for the national team. And so they got two comedians and a Britpop group named the Lightning Seed to record Football's Coming Home. Or it's the song is actually called Three Lions. But the chorus, which is coming home, football's coming home, has kind of become this, first became a chant and then has morphed since then. But the song itself is very defeatist. It's all about how England always loses and how that they remain optimistic even though they know the team is going to fail, probably on penalty kicks.
Which is a lie. They don't remain optimistic, as discussed earlier in the show.
Exactly. The song is... It was recorded before the 1996 European Championships that were in England. And that tournament, of course, England lost on penalties to Germany in the semifinals. But the genius of the song is the fact that it's not past tense. It's always about maybe one day it will be coming home. Maybe one day we will be winning. So in the 22 years since it was recorded, it has taken on a life of its own because they have not won yet.
And maybe they would never will. We'll see. Should we do Lightning Seeds as a tribute to the artists?
I think that's appropriate. Although the two comedians wrote the lyrics and the Lightning Seeds did the music, but that's enough because I'm not familiar with the work of any of the parties involved beyond Three Lions.
David Baddiel and Frank Skinner being the comedians. But let's do Lightning Seeds. It's a catchier. Catch your name. Nick, what is your lightning seed for the week?
Oh, I want to talk about diving in soccer. I don't mind diving. I feel like people who harp on about the human element in other sports get very upset about diving in soccer. It seems like that's the kind of person that would do that. Yet diving is the most human element you can have. It involves lying, involves deceit, and involves a little bit of comedy. It's like the full spectrum of Shakespearean emotion and artistry. Now, beyond that, I know people think that there should be harsher punishments for diving. You are supposed to yellow card someone who simulates being fouled in the box. Yet that, I don't think that's happened yet in this World Cup. I know in the Belgium-Brazil game, Neymar, who's been kind of the diver number one in the 2018 World Cup, really did dive in the box late in the game, but the referee just kind of waved him up and did not give him a card. I think that's pretty appropriate punishment because what is more humiliating than having a referee of all people, dismissively just kind of brush you aside, say, get up, you're not very hurt. But I want to talk about the one time that someone actually was punished harshly for diving. And that came in 1989 when Brazil and Chile were had a winner goes through to the World Cup qualifying match. It was held in Brazil. And after Brazil took a 1-0 lead in the second half, Roberto Rojas, Chile's goalkeeper, fell to the ground. and he lied there for a long time. There were flares that had been thrown by Brazilian fans onto the pitch, and he had said that he got hit in the head with a flare. What's more, he was gushing blood from his forehead. And the Chilean players, in protest, said, we can't keep playing this game here. This is completely unsafe conditions. And so they stretchered him off the field. The players left in protest and demanded that another game be played in a neutral field so that they would, you know, could start again and not have to worry about these horrible fans throwing firecrackers at their goalkeeper. The next day, officials reviewed the video evidence and found that a firecracker, while it was thrown near Rojas, it didn't hit him. It landed a meter away. What he had done was hid a razor blade in his glove, in his goalkeeping glove, and sliced his forehead open. The idea was that they wanted to have a game on a neutral field so they'd have a better chance of making the World Cup. And after going down 1-0, they figured, you know, that's the best way we're going to do it. The coach was in on it. The team trainer was in on it. And in response, FIFA banned Roberto Rojas for life from soccer. It ended his career right then and there. The ban was eventually lifted in 2001, but he was already, you know, way past his playing career by then. So for that dive against Brazil in 1989, Roberto Rojas had his career ended. The moral of the story is dive as much as you want, but just don't bring wrestling kayfabe gambit into it.
Don't blade yourself during my after ball, Nick. I mean, I know that you like to bring attention to yourself, but we have limits.
I am a prima donna to the point of self-injury. And Josh, what is your lightning seed for today?
My lightning seed for today, of all days, is part of my two-part series of Josh thinks deeply about penalty shootouts once every 2 to 4 years. Part one last week being about cinematography. Part two this week being maybe choreography, I would say. We'll get to it in a second. But first, a little recap, Nick, of the penalty shootouts from this World Cup. There have been four. First was Spain-Russia. It was 1-1 after regulation, 1-1 after extra time, and Russia won on penalties. Croatia-Denmark was 1-1 after regulation, 1-1 after extra time, and Croatia won on penalties. Mm-hmm. Colombia-England was 1-1 after regulation, 1-1 after extra time, and England won on penalties. And then Russia-Croatia, 1-1 after regulation, and they actually scored in extra time. It was 2-2 after extra time, and Croatia won on penalties. But 3 out of 4 games, no goals in extra time, and then it was settled in the shootout. Because of that, Martin Rogers of USA Today wrote a piece arguing, let's save us all some time and just go straight to a shootout. That's a bad idea, Martin, if I can use your first name. It's not a bad idea because extra time is sometimes good, as it was in the 2014 World Cup final when Mario Götze scored in the 113th minute to lead Germany over Argentina. Rather, it's a bad idea to just go straight to a shootout because extra time and the penalty shootout actually do work well together. It's just that they need to be arranged differently. In 2016, Dario Perkins wrote a piece for Slate that proposed what I think is a brilliant solution. But before we get to the solution, let's restate the problem. At the time that Perkins wrote the piece, 13 Champions League finals since 1983 had finished in a tie after regulation, and 11 of those 13 ended up going to penalties. As Perkins noted, and has been the case in this World Cup, although extra time is supposed to be exciting, the players are tired. They often seem content to play out the extra 30 minutes at three-quarter speed. They settle for the draw, and then they try to win on penalties. So here's Perkins' idea, and I'm quoting here. Play the penalties before extra time. If one team outscores the other in the subsequent 30 minutes of open play, then that result will trump the outcome of the penalty kicks. If extra time ends in a draw, then the game goes to the penalty winner. What is your gut reaction to that, Nick Green?
Well, I think it's clever, but with the kind of narrative arc of a game, having the most climactic part happen after regulation but before extra time kind of throws everything out of whack.
Well, it just depends on, you know, obviously you have a very traditional view of the game, Nick, and a very traditional view, conventional view of story structure.
That's what they say about me. Also, I'm going to give you a lame argument that is probably not even a good argument, but I think I should force you to defend anyway. What if someone gets injured during the penalties?
What if someone gets injured in the penalties? You know, I'll let FIFA sort that out because they're generally like good and smart about these things. I'm sure that they've considered that. You know, just sum somebody in. I'm sure it'll be fine. Extra sub. There's an extra sub for extra time. So
I like that now. That's a good rule.
Yeah, you get the fourth substitution. The other point that Perkins made, which I think will win you over, is that there is not any way that a penalty shootout can end. It's impossible for it to end without somebody being the GOAT. Because somebody has to miss for there to be a winner, and penalties are, I guess it could just go on until the, you know, sun burns out. But typically in games that we've seen, somebody misses and that's, you know, determines the winner of a penalty shootout. It's unfair after a whole long game that's, you know, soccer is a team game, allegedly, that the spotlight ends up being on this one poor soul who misses a penalty. And
that's what it's about, baby. You got to separate the winners and the loser chokers.
But as we saw in the Croatia-Denmark game, Luka Modric got a penalty in extra time. He missed, was saved by Schmeichel, the Danish keeper. And all the Croatian players talked afterwards about how they were so motivated to win because they didn't want Modric to feel bad. And so just think of how there's going to be like supercharged energy to win these games after the penalty shootout, because what's going to happen is, all right, let's imagine England loses on penalties to Germany.
And some
hypothetical future game. England is going to be just like driving for a goal like crazy in the extra time period, knowing that the only way that they can win is by scoring a goal. And just the drama, I know that you like the climax of like just seeing some dude like walk glumly off the field, but the drama of just watching them press for a goal as opposed to the usual slog of extra time, it would be amazing.
Something tells me that if England lost to Germany or lost penalty shootout to Germany before extra time, they wouldn't be heroically charging at the Germans' goal. I think the general demeanor would be pretty depressing.
Well, I think that's what you'd imagine. I'd like to see that that tested in the laboratory of real life. But this maybe falls in the category of something that's fun and whimsical, but will never happen.
I say just bring back the original MLS penalty kicks, where the taker starts at midfield and the goalkeeper can charge out of his net at any time he wants, and they basically have a sort of hot potato kind of game of chicken with two players sprinting directly at each other. That was terrible for injuries. It took too long, but it was the most exciting thing in the history of the MLS.
On that note of praise of MLS, that is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Our intern is Meredith Ellison. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Nick Green, I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.